So I've been inspired for this evening to explore a topic that, in many ways, is responding to some of what's happening in our world, and that is to explore how our Dharma practice, our Buddhist practice, connects with and guides us in transforming, I would just say, in understanding and transforming racism. So that's a theme I want to work with today. And in particular, I'm going to look at four major resources from our Dharma practice that can really help us and give us some guidance and some perspective. And also can make clear where we have need for further resources. So that's the theme, and I'm thinking also of continuing with the theme next week. And so, I was thinking the context in which we are exploring this is what one friend called the triple pandemic. So we have the virus, we have all that's happening with racism, and not to overly depress you on a Sunday night, but we also have the climate crisis, the climate disruption. And of course, we could add to that the economic distress. So it's a challenging time for human beings. And yet we also have good resources. So I wanted to say a little bit about my approach here, because I think in going into this area, it's important to have a certain degree of humility to acknowledge that the exploration of this can be sometimes awkward. I may say things which are awkward or quote unquote make mistakes. I, like all of us, have blind spots. So I just wanted to acknowledge that. And, part of what we'll be exploring is that we've all internalized a lot of social conditioning. And I also wanted, in a way, at the beginning, to acknowledge my own standpoint, my own background, which is as a man of Jewish background, Jewish ancestry. Like those of you who are Jewish, you may have experienced when I was growing up, I was at times still treated like an other. I was othered sometimes by the other kids when I was growing up. I could feel something like that because I internalized wanting to hide aspects of my identity. And I know that, and some of you may have experienced something similar. My name was perpetually misspelled where I was growing up. I grew up in Maryland, outside of Washington, D.C. And, I also have a history where my father was not able to go to medical school because he was Jewish. At the time, they had quotas. They actually had quotas in many schools, medical schools, but also the Ivy League schools had quotas related to Jewish people up until the early 1960s. And I'll come back to that point. And yet also, my parents were considered, white for other purposes, and my father was able to get the GI Bill after serving in World War II, go to college, and I think get loans for buying a first home. And as many of many African Americans did not have those advantages. So that's my background, right? That, as many of in the 19th and early 20th century, many groups we now call white were not considered fully white. You know, there were always two kind of standards of whiteness. One was immigration from the, I think, 1790 immigration law. And all the people we now call white were white for immigration purposes, but for social purpose, not always considered white. And it's a pretty, I'll come back to this, it's a pretty interesting history. I mean, I found that in the early 20th century, Swedish people were not really considered fully white in many circles. Interesting, isn't it? And many of you know Irish were not white in much of the 19th century for social purposes. For immigration, they were. But for social purposes, and maybe some of you have seen cartoons about the Irish from the 19th century, which shows the Irish as looking like African Americans. And same thing with Italians and people from Eastern Europe. Generally, that all shifted by the 1950s and 1960s. You know, and there was more of a homogenized. Anyways, that's part of my background, you know, that things are complex and interesting. And so as I explore this also, I want to do so with, you know, just sensitivity and in our discussion, you know, when one looks into these matters with a group, it's always helpful to really have sensitivity, have empathy, be careful about shaming or blaming. You know, that's the best way to inquire. So, you know, the whole area has a lot of confusion and a lot of insecurity maybe, just about wanting to be a good person, all of us, and so forth. So, I think many of us know that. So I want to give four perspectives on that come from Buddhist practice, from the Dharma, on transforming racism. The first one is remembering that the Buddha strongly contested the caste system of the India of his time. Maybe I'll say what the four points are. The first is that. The second that I'll come to in a moment is that it's helpful when we look to the teachings about eliminating or transforming greed, hatred, and delusion to also understand that greed, hatred, and delusion are not just individual, but they're institutionalized as well. The third point is to use the teachings on emptiness in part, which I'll explain very briefly when I get there, to use the teachings on emptiness to understand better how race is a construction and all constructions can be deconstructed, even if they've been operative for like 400 years. Okay, so that's the third point. And then the fourth point is looking at our grounding in ethical practice as a guide, you know, especially our commitment not to harm and not to be involved with harming, that can be a powerful incentive for our practice. So those are the four points. And then after that, I'll talk some about different ways to respond, and then we'll have some discussion together. So The first resource or the first perspective is that the Buddha was, in some ways, we could say, a kind of revolutionary opposing the caste system of his time, which was very linked with color. Those who were in the lower caste were generally darker skinned. Some historians think that the caste system came into place to distinguish the kind of the invaders of India who were more light-skinned from the darker-skinned natives. In other words, a number of groups of people came from the West, maybe around what we might call Iran and parts of the Middle East, and they went into India and they, in a sense, took over and they wanted to keep the subjugation of the local people. And again, some historians think the caste system originates there. But the caste system was very rigid and still is fairly rigid. And there were four basic castes or classes of people. And if you're born into a caste, you couldn't really change it. It was your fate for life. There was the class of the Brahmins or the priests who were supposed to be the most pure people. There were the warriors. That's where the Buddha came from, the second caste. There were the merchants and traders. And then there were those who were the lowest class, who were the workers. They were sometimes treated almost like slaves. And then there were the outcasts, called the Sudras, who were worse than any and were considered highly, highly impure. And there was very little contact between the different castes. And so the Buddha deeply, deeply criticized the caste system, as many of you know. And he welcomed anyone, including those who were not even in a caste. He invited everyone to join the community. Really revolutionary at the time in many ways. We could say that the Buddha was less revolutionary in regard to gender and the status of women, but maybe that's another discussion. But he did invite, nonetheless, women into the Sangha as well, which was also a big shift from what must have been the norm at the time. And so there are famous passages where the Buddha says, by birth, one is not a member of the outcast. By birth, one is not a Brahmin. But rather, it is by deeds alone that one is an outcast. By deeds alone, one is a Brahmin. And this must have been maddening or infuriating to those in the upper castes at the time. They probably did the equivalent of incessant tweeting all the time about the Buddha. Who is this guy, you know? Every morning they would tweet negatively about the Buddha or do the equivalent. But anyway, that is a resource. The fact it's helpful to know that the tradition itself comes out of that history. And that, even though the caste system was even made more rigid in the time after the Buddha, many of the Buddhist traditions really kept that openness to anyone. And I know in some of the later Mahayana and Vajrayana traditions, many of the great yogis, many of the great teachers came from the lowest caste or even were in the outcast. You know, you can read, you know, if you read about those who are called the 84 Siddhas, who are the great yogis who were the inspiration for Tibetan Buddhism, much of Tibetan Buddhism. Many of them, you read their biographies, a lot of them come from the lower caste, from the outcast, and it's really interesting. And so that has stayed with the Buddhist tradition, that opposition. So very, very important perspective. So that's the first. The second perspective is that it's helpful to understand our intention to transform greed, hatred, and delusion, not only on an individual level, but on an institutional level. That greed, hatred, and delusion are not just personal actions, but they get institutionalized. And then, of course, we internalize the messages of the institutions. We internalize the messages of the culture. And so it's helpful to have this perspective to see that the transformation of greed, hatred, and delusion, you know, and we could fit racism in as institutionalized hatred in a way, that that's part of our practice if we want to transform greed, hatred, and delusion. And so a few words about racism. Many people say that it's the core wound of this society, sort of the core unresolved issue. In Buddhist language, we could say it's the fundamental social dukkha of this society, you know, in part along with the near genocide of native people. And it's seems pretty clear that we can't be a healthy society, and I would say healthy individuals, without addressing racism, without addressing, you know, let's say our part in it, without being committed to transform it. But I'm wanting to here see that as very aligned with our practice of transforming greed, hatred, and delusion. So we know the history. We know the history of slavery, in which people of African descent were primarily treated as useful bodies to do labor. We're not treated as full human beings. And, you know, the legacy, obviously, of that is still there. You know, that there weren't ways to, after the Civil War, to make that right. You know, and I was listening to some of the memorial for George Floyd, and one of the congressional representatives, I think Al Green from Texas, he spoke of how there's still a need for reconciliation. You know, and I know, my congressperson, Barbara Lee, has called for basically the equivalent of the truth and reconciliation process that took place in South Africa. And so, again, I'll say some things which may be quite familiar, but we know that the legacy is still there of slavery. People of African descent, and I want to say that racism is not just focused on people of African descent. I think we know that, but I'm focusing there especially. Black people die at a younger age. They're generally hungrier and sicker. They have a lower birth rate, a higher rate of infant mortality, a much higher chance of breathing toxic fumes, worse health care. They're incarcerated at 5 times the rate of white people. I think probably many of you know that the median wealth of white people is over 10 times greater than that of black people. The net worth of a typical white family is, as of 2016, was $171,000. The net wealth of an average black family, $17,000. So the many reasons for that, obviously part of the reasons are inequality, discrimination, differences in opportunity. When I mentioned, you know, that my family had benefited in the time after World War II from the GI Bill and the loans that were available to buy houses, those were highly restricted to people of African descent. Some of you know that. I think there's a local author named Richard Rothstein who did a book on that and often does presentations. If you want to get more detail, you can look his name up. But it's, you add all this together, And you can understand maybe some of the rage. You know, I was one of my African American colleagues said a few days ago, my insides are screaming right now. I was talking with a neighbor who talked with an African American colleague at work who said, I have not been able to get out of bed for 3 days. And there's some way that we who are not black, especially those who are racialized as white, we know this in some way. You know, I remember seeing a speaker with an audience, and she asked the audience, how much money would it take for you to agree to become a black person? How about $1 million? Would you take $1 million and become a black person? How about 2 million? For that audience, there was no amount by which they would agree. What does that say? It says that we know what's happening, right? There's some way that we know. And yet, when we tune in there, we might be more motivated to respond, that there's some way that what's happening when we tune into it is a kind of rupture with our collective humanity in some way. And so it's helpful in terms of the Buddhist framework to see that dukkha, this kind of semi-conscious pushing away, grabbing hold, one of the forms of which is hatred or ill will, gets institutionalized. You know, there are many forms of that, but racism is one form, we might say, of institutionalized hatred, institutionalized dukkha. You know, that there's a kind of institutionalized hatred and fear which manifests through racism, manifests through the law, through, you know, and again, not just not just towards African Americans, but you can see it in the immigration laws. Can see it, you know, there, you know, after a lot of immigration, and this is goes back to what I was saying earlier about changing notions of who's white. Some of you know in 1924, it was decided that there were too many people who had come in from Eastern Europe and Southern Europe. And so they passed a very restrictive law, which also, you know, furthered the exclusion also of Asian people. And they had very, very strict laws that tried to say just immigrants from the acceptable places, you know, mostly Northwestern Europe, right? And that didn't change until 1965. So there's institutionalized hatred through the immigration laws, through obviously through the police, the judicial system. And there's also, I like my colleague David Loy has really written eloquently about how greed, hatred, and delusion get institutionalized. One book that he does this with is called Money, Sex, War, and Karma. A very nice book, has a chapter on institutionalized greed, hatred, and delusion. And, you know, there's a certain delusion which occurs also through lack of proper education, through aspects of the media. I was thinking that is very prominent today. Some of you know news in the last week or so. Our Attorney General, Mr. Barr, says, I don't think that the law enforcement system is systemically racist, right? That's the Attorney General, right, speaking, and other members of the administration said more or less the same thing. So we all internalize this, and so we need a kind of practice in which we work with our greed, hatred, and delusion on many levels in our individual behavior, but also in what we've internalized, and also how we might respond to the larger world. So again, it's kind of a vision of doing both inner work and work that helps to transform the harm in our social world. How do we have a sense of practice which brings together both? You know, and again, I'm talking here about racism. We could talk similarly about climate issues or other issues. This is from the writer Angel Kyoto Williams, who co-authored a book called Radical Dharma, which has a lot of good material in it. She said, love and justice are not two. Without inner change, there can be no outer change. Without collective change, no change matters. I might say that last phrase a little differently, but she's basically talking about the need to combine those two. Okay, so first perspective, the Buddha's example with the caste system, kind of being an activist, we might say. The Buddha as activist, right? And then secondly, the need to, with our Dharma eyes, to see the world and to see greed, hatred, and delusion, not just in our individual actions, but also in our institutions and cultures. And then to take our practice as dedicated to the transformation of greed, hatred, and delusion generally. The third perspective is, I mentioned, that of emptiness, which is a topic that I will explain very, very simply. Commonly can be a confusing area, but I will interpret emptiness simply as meaning that all phenomena are an ever-changing grouping of interrelated causes and conditions. Another way of saying is that any sense of there being a person or a thing is just basically a construction by our thinking and our minds. Did that help explicate emptiness? Another way of saying it is just a construction. That's the simplest way to explain emptiness. Just a conceptual construction, and that everything is always changing, and yet our language makes it look like it's not changing, right? It's always changing and deeply interrelated with all sorts of phenomena. Our language makes things look like they're isolated and last forever, okay? And so, let's see. So the application of that to racism is really, really important. And I think as practitioners, we can basically see that racism is a construction which occurred at a certain point in history, gained power, and it can be deconstructed. It can be deconstructed in our minds, it can be deconstructed socially. So it's helpful to actually look and see how that construction took place, because it actually occurs fairly precisely in history. And so if we have more the sense that racism is a construction, that occurred for particular reasons, it really helps us in being maybe more optimistic that it can be transformed, even though there's, we might say, heavy karma. You know, and I'm thinking back to an interesting experience I had over 30 years ago. I was doing a 3-month retreat. And right in the middle of that 3-month retreat, you know, meditating 16 or 18 hours a day, in the middle of it, suddenly, right in the middle of the day, I thought, interestingly, 30 years ago, racism can end. Ah, that was it. I didn't think about it a lot, but there was something, where did that come from? Just out of the blue. And I had that sense that it was, you know, there were maybe, I think it was the loosening of my mind. And I just said, oh, everything is in essence fluid. Things can get stuck, but they're not 100% stuck. And I just had some kind of vision there. And I think that can be helpful to realize that racism is a construction. So it's helpful to know that the concept of race only really starts appearing, and the concept of white and black only starts appearing at the very end of the 17th century. The Oxford English Dictionary says that the first use of white in print was in 1671. And a lot of this history occurs in the Virginia colonies in the 1600s. So here's a brief version of that history. In the Virginia colonies, there were people who were slaves from Africa. There were indentured servants from England and other places. A lot of them worked together in the fields. Slavery was not that rigid. People could buy themselves out of slavery. They could stop being slaves. And at that time in Virginia, mid-1600s, there was a lot of fluidity. People did not think of themselves as white or black. You know, they were of this or that European descent. They were of African descent and so forth, or they were identified by their religion. They weren't identified as white or black. There was a lot of fluidity. There were people we now call blacks who became property owners. There was intermarriage quite a bit. And there was a lot of common work together. In 1676, there was a rebellion by many of the workers against the ruling elites, the wealthy. In that rebellion, whites and blacks, people we now call whites and blacks, were together. They were unified and acting together against the wealthy. This was a huge shock. His actual rebellion, it's called Bacon's Rebellion, a little more complex, but that's the essence of it, you know, especially for our perspective. The wealthy rulers, the landowners, they got very nervous, and they basically decided that they needed to, we would say, divide and conquer. And so they set up a system which is still very much with us, in which they stoked a sense of racial resentment. They started calling people whites and blacks fairly soon after that. Right after that is when the slave laws got hugely rigid. Slavery became hereditary. It was declared that whites could not be slaves. They set up the slave patrols, which were the antecedents of the policing systems. They set up the slave patrols with poor whites who were given a sense of these people are dangerous. We need to guard against them. Whereas a short time before that, people were not scared of each other. Do you get the picture? There's a whole sense of divide and conquer that took place. This is from one of the great historians, Edmund Morgan. He said, there was an obvious lesson for the rulers. Resentment of an alien race might be more powerful than resentment of an upper class. Is that familiar? Do you recognize that in recent American history? You know, basically, race is a construction designed to divide and conquer. And that kind of logic, people can see that very, very clearly with the contemporary administration, right? One can see how racism is used as divide and conquer. How many people can relate to that, can see something like that? Yeah, and you can go back, and they're good books. One of the books I've been reading, which is very good on this, it's by a Berkeley professor named Ian Haney Lopez, who wrote a book called Dog Whistle Politics. And the latest book is called Merge Left, Fusing Race and Class, Winning Elections and Saving America. And you can look him up on YouTube. He really makes this point well, that basically undoing the divide and conquer strategy is the way to go forward, right? So, but we can see that kind of construction occurring. And we can see, you know, we can see how that construction has been so negative, and it changed history, and it can be deconstructed, right? Again, that's what we learn from our practice, that we don't have to buy into constructions. So I give you that history, I think, to see, in particular, the constructed nature. So I hope that's both helpful and quite interesting. You know, I find it really fascinating to know how that construction occurred. And, you know, and after that, after I think the new slave laws were about 1700 started, and after that, all sorts of things developed. People developed, you know, concepts of race and biology. Of course, nowadays, most biologists and social scientists, or virtually all of them, say that race is a total construct with no biological meaning, right? Interesting, right? So that's the third point that I better finish up soon so we have some discussion. So that's the third point, that racism is based on a construction and we can deconstruct it. And maybe I'll give my third point about ethics next week, okay? But maybe I'll give it really briefly now and more next week. So basically, it's to say that in our ethical practice, we make a commitment not to harm, not to steal, and to be very careful with energies which are often difficult, sexuality, speech, and substances which shift consciousness. And we can also, and there are many advocates of this, also see our ethical commitment to involve our being in the world. It's not just about what I individually do, but that I have a commitment to intervene when harm is being done. And you can find this actually in the teachings of the Buddha, that he says, interpreting the ethical precepts in different places, something like, do not kill, do not approve of others killing. It's not entirely individual. You know, and this is from This is from Thich Nhat Hanh. We cannot support any act of killing. No killing can be justified. But not to kill is not enough. We must also learn ways to prevent others from killing. We cannot say, I am not responsible. They did it. My hands are clean. If you were in Germany and during the time of the Nazis, you could not say, they did it, I did not. So maybe I'll speak more about that next time, but it's really saying that if we take our ethical commitment seriously, I think it also calls on us to respond to harm, you know, that's being done in our name in a way or with our implicit agreement. So I'll try to finish just in a few minutes so we can have some time to talk. So how to respond? I like Joanna Macy's model for three ways to move towards the society that is sustainable. She talks about holding actions which prevent further damage, changing our institutions, and changing consciousness. And so I'll be brief on each of those. How do we prevent further damage from occurring? Here we might, if we wish, join in protests, support organizations which are trying to prevent further damage being there. Secondly, we can change institutions. You know, maybe we want to have, you know, support a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Maybe along those lines, consider reparations. You know, obviously this is connected with changing our policing institutions, but we can also look at our own institutions, our own sangha, our own workplaces, and even our own families. Are there ways that we can intervene? One person whose work I also like a lot, named David Kampf, he is an African-American. He wrote the book called The White Ally Toolkit Workbook. And his whole thing is to develop empathic listening in people so they can talk with people in their own extended families on the other side of the divide, and particularly around race. He thinks that people don't have to give up being conservative to be against racism. Anyway, very interesting. Look him up. C-A-M-P-T, Kampf. So, and then lastly, we can change consciousness. We can learn more about the history, educate ourselves, and a very, very important way to learn is to be in something like what are called affinity groups, to be in small groups which look at racism and conditioning with people with whom you can feel relatively safe and to explore. And, you know, I've personally been in a number of these groups. My colleague Ruth King is developing a whole year-long program which starts in September. You can look up her website. You could join an affinity group or form one and be part, and they're usually groups of 5, 6, 7 people in which you have a curriculum. A lot of it's talking about one's own conditioning. It's done in a no blame, no shame manner. And it can be a very, I think it's a very important adjunct to meditation. And I think in time, it'll be recognized as part, an integral part of our practice. And there are multiple groups like this. There's another organization called White Awake. I was inspired by my colleague Aya Ananda Bodhi, who has a nuns community near Placerville. And in that community, everyone goes through a curriculum. It's called Wake Up, W-A-I-C dash up. You can look that up on the web. It's a whole, you can actually download a whole curriculum from there. So let me finish just by inviting you to go inside for a moment and ask, how do I feel called in this area? Was there something that resonated from my speaking? Do you have a sense of next steps you'd like to take? So let me finish there and invite any comments or questions, any reflections of any kind. Okay, and maybe since we have more than 25 people, I can't see everyone. Should we do, did you instruct people on the raise hands function? Okay, Bill.
I didn't, but you'll see there's a button down at the bottom of the screen that says participants. When you click on that, you'll see something across the bottom. Unfortunately, I don't get it because I'm a host, but you'll see something that says, I think, raise hand. And it'll show a little hand icon, and Donald will see a sign saying that somebody's raised their hand and giving a name.
And then I'll say, thank you, whatever. Linda, please speak, and you can unmute yourself at that point. Okay, so anyone like to make a comment, ask a question? Mary, please.
Thank you, Donald. This is wonderful. I just loved it. And something I've noticed in the last 6 months that has been very hopeful to me is that if you pay attention to what's going on in advertising,
mm-hmm.
You probably don't watch a lot of TV, Donald, but if you happen to watch any, yeah, right. But if you do watch just regular TV, every ad now is mixed race,
mm.
and frequently even gay couples and mixed race couples.
Mm.
It is completely different. And when you see a couple, or when you see people in the ad that are all white, it's weird.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is helping.
Yeah, I think we can, many people are saying this is the moment of a generation right now. And so the energy seems to be different. It seems unlikely things will just bubble for a while and fade away. And so it really is inviting us, do we want to be part of that? And again, there's a lot of ways you might agree or disagree with tactics and so forth, but how do we want to be connected to that, to the best of what's developing? Anyone else like to, again, comment or ask something? Maybe ask me to clarify something? Leo, yeah, or Sarah.
Okay, can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. One of the things that I find really fascinating through our recent administration is that I really believe that if we didn't have this administration, we wouldn't have the mobilization that we have, that it has actually taken us to a point where we needed to change. And where I don't think if we had, say, Hillary win, we would not have had this kind of movement going on.
Mm.
That's what I really observe.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that kind of analysis. It's many people had the thought that, right, this is like the shadow of the society and culture is out of the shadows, so to speak. Yeah.
Really?
It's right. It's right there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sarah, did you want to say something?
I wanted to answer the thing about the shadow, because I also feel like the disease has come to a head. You know, it's like this huge, and we're in a lot of danger. But I'd like to hear what you have to say about the prison movement.
About, could you be maybe a little closer to the mic would be helpful to me.
The prison movement. I was active in the prison movement very many years ago. And now the sheer number of African Americans who are incarcerated.
Yeah.
How to even begin with doing something about that, because it's terrible.
Yeah, I would tend to see it more as like more the symptom, right? I mean, it's related to that whole listing of facts that I gave, right? So it's part of a whole set of phenomena that are occurring. You know, and I think, you know, many people have spoken eloquently and written books. Was it Michelle Alexander wrote about just the history of the drug laws, right? Which is a major reason why African America in prisons. We know that the laws were enforced in different ways, right? The statistics are there in terms of drug users who are white rate of going to prison as opposed to African Americans. So there are all sorts of there are all sorts of phenomena there. But yeah, so what are you really asking? Maybe one way to say it is, I think one thing that was occurring to me in terms of a question of how to respond, you know, and seeing this as part of our practice, what would it be like if each of us said, I want to devote 5 hours a week to transforming racism. What's the best way for me to devote, you know, to put those 5 hours in? Maybe some of us would be reading, getting better educated, being in a group, or devoting oneself to a particular issue like that. That was part of my thinking, you know, of what would it be like if we saw this as just an integral part of our practice and said, I want to put 5 hours and then see where that 5 hours a week goes, or, you know, or more. So, Barbara, did I get at that some? You're muted. Sorry. I'm sorry, you're muted.
Sorry.
I'm trying to.
My question was not too clear. I've been hearing and reading a lot about prisons lately.
Yeah.
And I have some experience from years ago, and educating people about this incarceration, maybe educating other white people, but it just seems like such a huge crisis right now, especially with the virus. I mean, it's a life and death thing for a lot of people because of all these people locked up.
That's right. Yeah, it's a huge issue, and it's, again, a lot of it in the last 30 or 40 years is connected with crazy laws about what we call drugs. Yeah. I have a cousin who died young because, and I don't know how connected it was, but he was convicted under the drug laws and was going to be sent away for a long time. He decided to go underground. And it totally changed, and we could say in some ways really damaged his life. And he died younger than he needed to die, right? So the laws are crazy, were crazy. Yeah. Maybe one or two more, if we have any. Tom, yeah.
Yes, thank you, Donald. completely agree with your historical analysis regarding race and it becoming over time a proxy for class and economic oppression. So that really makes me think that, you know, the primary problem is greed rather than hatred. But you know, I guess greed begets hatred, but your analysis makes greed primary, and I think that's an important one, and that's even a level at which we all can work, I suppose, is try to make opportunity for, you know, more equal, more fair, and really call that out as you know, unequal opportunity, call it for what it is.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. That's a great point. Yeah, I mean, you said it in a way that hadn't occurred to me, but yeah, if that history that I gave makes it clear that hatred is a tool, as it were, manipulated on the basis of greed. That racism is a manipulative strategy of those who have greed to maintain the inequality, maintain their power, right? And you can see that. I mean, it seems to be very obvious right now, but you can see that throughout U.S. history. And so another way of talking about it is to say that it's really crucial to link racial justice with economic justice. Not easy, right? But, you know, people like Bernie Sanders would do that. But that's a very, very crucial point. And I think, not always easy to do. You know, I mean, but again, this book by Ian Haney Lopez is a very good book. And he, as an author, really lays out that point really, really well. And again, he's at UC Berkeley in the law school. And he also has talks on YouTube, which can give you a short account of what he's saying. I find it very, very compelling, because it's based also on that analysis of the roots of racism. You know, basically dividing the ones we now call white and black, and telling, and in recent history, telling white working class people the reason that you're not well off is because of them, right? That's the strategy, obviously still being directly used nowadays. That's the problem. It's them, and it's not the rulers, right? Yeah. Okay. How many would like to, in your own way, explore this a little bit more in the next week? Maybe do some reading or just look up, if you'd like to, look up Ruth King. Is a colleague at Spirit Rock based in North Carolina. She has a one-year program starting in September. Another resource, again, is Wide Awake. You can look at their websites. And then there's this other curriculum developed by people in Spirit Rock's Community Dharma Leader program called Wake Up, WAIC-UP, which I looked up on the web earlier today, and you can find it. And the curriculum is freely available. You could do that curriculum with, three friends. You could develop your own group, no cost, or you could be part of one of the groups with the other organizations where there is a fee, but it's not very much. Okay, so let's go to the meta cards now to finish up.